Well, welcome everyone. It's good to see you all tonight. I'm so excited to be here at Spirit of Truth Outreach. And again, I'm Chris Berg. It's a pleasure to see you guys here. And tonight we're going to be discussing the Divine Decree Theology Proper. And this is part of our Cleaning House series where we're going through systematic theology. Now, I'd like to start by saying that this talk in particular is actually one of the most difficult. There's a number of reasons for this. So first, it by far has the most technical language. It's also got some of the most difficult concepts, and it's very philosophical, this understanding of the divine decree. So what we're going to do, and this might be multiple weeks, we might end up taking 2 or 3 weeks on this just because of the nature of how difficult this one can be, how complex it can be, and how important it is. Because divine decree is sort of the thing upon which so many other theological concepts hang. Virtually everything that has to do with the will of God hangs on this issue of the divine decree. So I want to make sure we take our time, that we do a good job on this. I'm probably going to cut the lecture portion at 45 minutes. I don't want to go too much more than that before we get to questions, because otherwise it's just going to be too much material at once. So without further ado, let's jump right into divine decree. Okay, so I first want to talk about the knowledge of God and this issue of free choice. And in order to do that, we're going to have to discuss a couple of terms that you'll want to keep handy. So first, let's hit on this. What is the relationship of the knowledge of God to his decree? In other words, what is the relationship of what God knows to what God has chosen, if you will, to be, to enact, to happen? And essentially, we can divide God's knowledge into either 2 or 3 categories. And this depends on the view one takes of this topic. So, for example, theological systems, okay, that are going to reject a libertarian understanding of will. And all libertarian agency or libertarian free will means is this. It just means that moral agents, or beings that can choose between right and wrong, have the capability to spontaneously, with no prior force or no prior coercion or no prior anything, nothing prior, they can generate a new response. They can generate a new action. Okay, that's what libertarian free will is. So for those who reject that, essentially God's knowledge is split into 2 things. First, you have necessary or natural knowledge. Now, necessary or natural knowledge, and we're going to get more into this later, I'll give you the brief definition now, is that knowledge which is inherent or innate to the Trinity. It is knowledge that God must have. He cannot not have it. It could not be different than it is. It couldn't even be different than it is. So it is that knowledge which is absolute. It's knowledge that is intrinsic to who he is. The second type of knowledge that God would have is a free or consequent knowledge. This is actually knowledge based on his divine decree. In other words, it's based on his choice. It could have been other than it was, but it is the way that it is because of his decree. So in other words, he has minimally 2 types of knowledge. He's got a knowledge that's born simply out of who he is, and he's got a knowledge based on his decree. Now, if people hold a libertarian agency, in other words, if they hold this idea that human beings can spontaneously generate actions of their own accord with no other external force, then there's a 3rd type of knowledge. Okay, this is called middle knowledge. Now, a middle knowledge, and again, we're going to dive more into these in a moment, but a middle knowledge is this idea that God can foreknow the actions of moral agents because he knows how they will act in a given situation. So in other words, you know, God essentially puts everyone in the situations they're in knowing how they're going to act. They still have to choose, but his knowledge is so extensive that he knows how they'll act. Okay. The decree, and this is very key, is not the foundation of his natural knowledge. His natural knowledge is just there. But his decree is the foundation of his free knowledge. It's the foundation of his free knowledge. So I want to read a couple verses here with you now. First, Isaiah 46, 8 through 11. I'm going to go ahead and pull that up. Okay, and I'll go ahead and read this now. Remember this and be brave. Take it to heart, you transgressors. Remember what happened long ago. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and no one is like me. I declare the end from the beginning, and from long ago, what is not yet done, saying, my plan will take place, and I will do all my will. I call a bird of prey from the east, a man for my purpose from a far country. Yes, I have spoken, so I will also bring it about. I have planned it, and I will also do it. Now, I want you to see in this verse, this is not a soft view. This is not a God who doesn't know. What level of sovereignty and knowledge are we seeing here? Well, he calls a bird of prey from the east. In other words, he seems to have command, if you will, or willing knowledge of even individual creatures in this world, and being able to set where they would live, what they would do, and how they would act and behave. And also calling a man for a purpose from a far country. I mean, that though the man chooses to go, it seems as though his call is going to be answered. Okay? So there's this idea that, yes, indeed, if we actually take that verse seriously, if we take it in the natural reading, it seems that God has a degree of knowledge and sovereignty that is extensive. Okay? It's extensive. And it's going to happen. Okay? All right, let's also take a look at Acts 2:23 as well. Acts 2:23. It says this, though he was delivered up according to God's determined plan and foreknowledge, you used lawless people to nail him to a cross and kill him. So right here we have a beautiful picture of God's foreknowledge and decree. God decreed that Jesus would die. It can also be simultaneously said, though, that it was people who, a lawless people, in fact, who put him to death. Now, I want to make a point at this because we're going to come back to this issue. It can be very difficult to see how both of those can be simultaneously true. This is one of those situations, and God does not do this often. He doesn't do this often. But it's one of those situations in which, and we're going to see two responses of God to questioning this issue, where God simply says, I cannot explain this to you in a way that you will understand. But to call into question my justice in a situation, who are you to do that? Stand before me and answer. Job says, answer me like a man. Did you put the stars in the sky? Do you feed all of the birds throughout the whole earth? I mean, the reality of the situation is there are certain things we're not going to be able to have a fully realized answer for. And one of them is how God can both determine an event to happen and simultaneously allow people to choose their way into basically making it happen. But that is indeed one of the things that Scripture affirms, and it affirms it right here. We're going to dive into it a lot, though, today. We're going to see if we can make some sense of this, but to some extent, we have to understand that we have to simply accept that this is true. Now, that's one of the issues with holding Scripture as your main theological method. If reason were, then we'd probably reject it because we couldn't make sense of it. We couldn't rationalize it. But that's why we don't hold reason at top. We hold Scripture at top. And it says that both God determined and to plan to crucify Jesus, and so did lawless people. So we have to affirm both. Okay. Now, we'll go ahead and move on. So again, a little bit more about this necessary or natural knowledge of God. Well, it's absolute. This is it's again 100% true kind of stuff. It's unbounded, it's unqualified. In other words, it's not based on anything. This is about as axiomatic as you can get. What I mean by that is this is about as bare ground true knowledge as you can possibly get. It's necessary. In other words, it cannot not exist. It can't be not part of God's mind, if you will. And it's according to his nature, okay, by which God perfectly knows himself and the whole range of all possible things. So this is the affirmation that God knows everything, essentially. It's an antecedent knowledge, which logically precedes the eternal decree. So in other words, the knowledge of possibilities, the knowledge of himself, is not based on his decree. Okay. This world, which is contingent, God had to decide to actualize it. And that's why the world and the universe and all created things constitute something we call free or consequent knowledge. Now, this just means the knowledge of all actual things brought freely into existence by the divine will operating within the range of possibility perfectly known to God. So in other words, God in his natural knowledge knows all possibilities. God in his consequent or free knowledge has chosen one of those possibilities to actualize, to make real. Okay? So two types of knowledge here. Now, this is where we get into the core of the argument. Most people don't realize this. The whole Arminian Calvinism thing, which we're going to discuss in great detail. Don't worry, we're going to be diving into that intensely. But what I want to mention first, though, is this. Is most people don't realize that that whole thing can stem back to basically the next premise that I'm going to say, which is that nothing outside of God's knowledge, nothing is outside of God's knowledge, because all things rest on the divine will. See, we have this problem where if something can come about outside of his divine will, then all of a sudden we have something that can, and I'm dead serious when I say this, think about this, assert itself over God. In other words, God's not in control. God has not actually orchestrated things. Like, if there's something outside of his will, then there's something outside of his power. There's something outside of his control. There's something outside of him. This is an issue. This is a very, very big issue. Because once you say libertarian free will, you now have to say that God created something over which he has no control. God created something that is outside of his realm of sovereignty. I mean, literally, that's where we're going here, if we're going to go in that direction. And so I want you to really wrestle with that, the idea that there is nothing outside of God's knowledge because all things rest on the divine will. In other words, nothing exists. Well, if God is going to bring into being a thing, actualize a world, actualize a creation, and that he has declared the end from the beginning, then is there something in that declaration at the end from the beginning that is outside of him, that is outside of his decree, that is outside of what he purposed to happen? Now, you have to understand there's a difference between what he desires and what his decree is, and we'll get into that later. But I want you to think about the reality, though. If we're going to start saying things like, well, yeah, things can happen outside of the will of God, that's not really true, and that has drastic consequences. So we'll get more into this in a moment. Now, again, we'll talk about evil. Evil's the big conundrum here, right? Because we don't want to say evil's within the divine will. However, we have to, actually. Otherwise, we have some serious issues. Now, how we do that is very important, because we can't make evil, for example, a direct primary cause of God, that he literally directly willed sin to happen. That doesn't make sense. That's contrary to his character. God cannot do something unholy or against his nature, but he can permit it to happen, and in the permission of him doing it happen, it is actually part of his will. So we have to discuss that. We will, don't worry. There's a lot to this. I want to talk a little bit about middle knowledge. I personally don't hold to middle knowledge. I don't hold to a libertarian free will, but I want to show you all the different possibilities here. Again, middle knowledge is the idea that people are going to choose things freely, but they're going to do it based on the situations they find themselves in. And so it's this idea that there is no true free choice in the sense that it's apart from any external influence, but it is still nonetheless a choice one actualizes. This is a William Lane Craig's view. It's also called Molinism. It's not a bad view. I wouldn't call it a bad view or anything. I just don't hold to it. It's not the view that I hold. Again, it's the middle knowledge is the knowledge that God has of what every free creature would freely do in every possible situation. So middle knowledge is a divine knowledge of conditional future contingent events. Now, what does that mean? Okay, it is divine knowledge, so it's knowledge that God has of conditional, which means these are things that could go one way or the other. Future, which means they haven't happened yet. Contingent, which means they may or may not be able to happen. Events of what persons would freely do under a given set of circumstances. Okay, middle knowledge is the kind of knowledge where God knows what each creature would do in each situation of libertarian free choice in which a creature could find itself in. So in other words, God knows everything because he knows how all people would react in all situations. Okay, again, that's not what I hold to, but I want to at least make you guys aware of it. Okay, so now let's talk about the freedom of will as it relates to God's knowledge. And I do want to give credit to Kevin Lewis, Dr. Lewis from Biola for a lot of these. A lot of what I'm reading and saying I'm pontificating on as well comes from his notes when I took this in his course. So thank you for that. The nature of practical freedom. So the first element in this is the absence of an absolute or hard determinism, which holds that all events are inevitable consequences of the antecedent sufficient or efficient causes. So the problem is this. If you're going to be a hard or absolute determinist, you basically don't believe in free will and or free choice. Okay? And if you're a hard determinist, it gets very difficult to hold people accountable for their actions because literally hard determinists say your actions are the direct result of the things that came before. So we have to deal with that. Second element is that the free choices and acts are those of the agent. That is, the free agent is the efficient cause of the movement of his will. Now, we have to understand causes. So we're going to talk about that as well. We're going to talk about the different types of causes. And we're going to talk about the different types, what we mean when we say causation. By the way, it's one of the hardest concepts in philosophy. When I took philosophy, when I took epistemology and metaphysics, and in the metaphysics portion, causation was absolutely the most difficult part of philosophy by far. It was more difficult to understand than anything else. So let's take a look at these various views on free choice. So one is, again, determinism, either hard or absolute style. And in this situation, one event determines, period, end of story, it absolutely determines another, if the latter is a consequence or necessitated by it. Okay. So there are things which are deterministic in the world. We're not saying there's not deterministic things. For example, the laws of nature act in a very deterministic way. I mean, if I jump out of a plane, I can't will myself to not fall. I'm going to fall to the ground. I mean, that's cause and effect, right? So there are some things that are determinist, but the question is, does that apply to the will? And I would disagree. It does not apply to the will in that level of hard determinism. Okay. But some would say that. For example, you're going to have a lot of evolutionists that are going to say that. You would even have some people in the Reformed perspective go into absolute or hard determinism. It's possible. Again, I don't hold to that, but we'll continue. Again, determinism implies the future is fixed and there's no possibility of an alternative development. Hard determinists hold it since human choices are causally determined by antecedent external causes, including the immediate efficient cause of the will by external causes. Genuine freedom is an illusion. So again, you have to go with the idea that freedom is an illusion if you go with this one. They reject the notion of free will or free choice, and they reject the idea of secondary free causes. Now, this is key. This is very, very, very key. Secondary free causes is essentially the way that I'm going to take on these things, is that we don't have the level of agency that God has. That'd be a libertarian agency. God is the only being in the universe that has a libertarian agency. And we'll actually see why. And I don't know when I'm going to get into it exactly, but we will talk about why the idea of humans having a libertarian free agency actually doesn't make sense. And in fact, it actually puts them in a permanent lock of indecision. We'll get to that in a bit. Okay. So what is libertarianism then? It's the far opposite side. So at hard determinism, what's libertarianism? Far opposite. Well, it's the idea that free choice is determined or efficiently caused by an agent, a person, who is not caused by an external efficient cause. In other words, the person purely internally and purely of its own self originates something completely new. The idea of counterfactuals of freedom is affirmed in this view as necessary to preserve genuine freedom. So in essence, you had to have the very real possibility of choosing otherwise. Okay. Definition of counterfactuals, the action is free only if the agent could or would have done otherwise if he had wanted to. Okay. Thus, the subjunctive or possible becomes the indicative or reality based on the free operation of the self-moved will. And the agent could always choose otherwise. Okay, is that actually the case? In between those two, you have something called compatibilism or soft determinism. So compatibilism is going to affirm that practical freedom means being able to do what one desires without external causation of the will. Thus, what one wants, as expressed by one's personality, character, or antecedent and concurrent circumstances and conditions. It's determined by external events such as genetics, culture, upbringing, but as long as the agent's able to act consistently with the choices made and the will is self-moved or self-caused, not caused by an external efficient cause, the agent's free. Again, what does this mean? Well, what this is basically saying is that one is going to act within one's nature. So one doesn't necessarily have the ability to do anything else, but one is going to act within one's nature. Okay, that's the key. This position is called compatibilism because, like hard determinism, it acknowledges that all events, including human free choices, have causes and are certain to occur and cannot be otherwise. However, soft determinism allows for free actions when the actions are self-caused by one's own choices rather than external causes. So this is the view that I would hold. And the issue is, again, I'm going to go through this very, very carefully. All events, including free human choices, have causes. So this is the main difference. The main difference is that all actions do have causes. Unlike the libertarian free will, which asserts that you can have a human action without a cause. Compatibilism says that no, all actions, including free ones, have causes, are affected by things. But it allows for free actions when the actions are self-caused by one's own choices rather than external causes. So we'll hit this in a moment. I know it's probably not super clear, but we'll dive more into it here. Okay. Let me go ahead and say this. Thus, in this view, the idea of practical freedom and responsibility is consistent or compatible with the concept of determinism, which is understood as every event being caused and rendered certain to occur in advance. Here, liberty is what? The power of doing or refraining from doing an action according to what one wills. Okay, I'm going to say it again. Liberty is the power of doing or refraining from doing an action according to what one wills, so that by choosing otherwise, one would have done otherwise. Agents fail to have liberty when either prevented from acting as one chooses or compelled to act in a manner contrary to what one wills. So here's the issue. The issue is, and let me say a little bit more and then I'll dive into this. Regarding compatibilism and causation, Reformed theologians such as Richard Mueller define free choice as the will being free from external constraint and from an imposed necessity, and the will itself is the sole efficient cause of its choice. Thus, the choice is efficiently caused by the agent choosing, and not any external agent acting upon the one choosing as the immediate efficient cause of the choice. Now, let me break this down, because I know that was probably a lot. So let me break this down. So the issue at play here is this. Can one, of one's own will, effect something that is wholly new and completely indifferent to anything that came before it? Or can we only cause things in our will, which are, in terms of morality, by the way, which are essentially out of our own nature or based on the effects that we have? So for example, I'll give you some example of this. Choice. How responsible is the drug addict? drug addict keeps going back to drugs. He may not even want to, but he keeps going. He keeps making that choice, and he's making the choice. Why? Because there's something else in the will. There's external forces on the will to either do or not do things. See, libertarianism is going to essentially deny that. It has to. It has to say that these things are completely free choices. But that doesn't seem how reality plays out. And in fact, when we start to look at the nature of humanity, which we will be doing at some point when we get to anthropology, we'll find that the will is actually comprised of two things, both inclination and volition. Volition being our decision-making capability, and inclination being our desires. And in fact, what you actually come to find out is that often we choose in line with our desires. And the desire that is strongest is the desire that wins out, and that is what we base our decisions upon. So it's interesting, because the libertarian actually has to say this, that what one wants to do has no actual impact on what one chooses to do. And this is very key. I want you to key in on this again. The libertarian, the one who truly asserts truly libertarian free will, has to say that there is no external causation of any kind that can impact one's decisions. Thus, one's desires cannot impact one's nothing. The decision has to just spontaneously arise. Now, if the decision spontaneously arises, well, one, why is it spontaneously arising? It seems like you're kind of stuck in a moment of indecision in the sense that why would anything ever come about? But secondarily, if a spontaneously arises, is there really any accountability there? You would just simply say, look, libertarian free will, I just chose it. I can't be held responsible. I didn't even want to choose it. I just was chosen by my soul. So there's some serious problems with that libertarian understanding. And actually, this makes more sense, that our decisions are indeed based on desires and external causes. How often do you make a decision? And you think about this. Do you ever really make decisions purely arbitrary? And even if you were able to, is that really a decision? That's the thing. I could just say random words, yes, but even in that, there is some decision to that. So, and it's not like I just randomly say things without deciding to say them. Okay. And there's a reason why I decided to say them. All right, so let's continue now. We'll talk about some additional theological considerations. So there are seven factors that we have to discuss when we talk about this issue of free choice and liberty. We have to discuss external agents, material and internal causes, God, the practical intellect, the mind, the goodness or evil of an object, the event itself, and its existence. So I want to go ahead and jump into some of this stuff. So first of all, when we talk about causation, we have to understand that causation is not simply what caused something. There are many types of causes. So we have to talk about efficient causes, impelling causes, proximate causes, material causes. And so this gets very confusing. Specifically, though, we're going to want to get to an efficient cause. That's the key one. So we're going to do that in a moment. Coaction. There's also another issue as well. That is, can you have coaction by an external agent? I would argue, yes, you can. And in fact, this is how in heaven and in the new heavens and new earth and the resurrection, human beings will be perfect. Because every action taken by a human being at that moment will be a co-action of God and man. And that is the perfectly sanctified state, is when essentially all actions are co-actions of God and man. Then man will do nothing that God does not wish him to do, and God will not have man do anything that should not be done. So we'll go ahead and take a look at these here. Okay, what I want to do as we proceed is talk about contingency and necessity as we do in free choices. So a contingent thing is neither impossible nor necessary. So something that's necessary cannot be other than what it is. For example, God. God simply is what he is. He has to be what he is. There's no other way about it. But I'm contingent. I could have been a lot of different things. I could have been a ditch digger. I could have been an astronaut. I mean, I could have been a lot of things. I could lose a finger. I mean, there's a lot of different contingent things about me. But necessary things are not like that. There's a couple of different ways to talk about this as well. One is absolute necessity. This is where a thing is absolute or simply necessary, because to deny it's self-contradictory. So, you know, for example, I think something to be absolute necessity. 1 + 1 = 2. I mean, that seems to be an absolute necessity kind of a thing. It just is what it is. To deny it doesn't make sense. You know, necessity of a consequent. This is a type of absolute necessity. It essentially arises out of a connection of necessary causes with the effects that must follow. So, because God exists, his decree must exist, right? That would be a necessity or a consequent, right? Okay. All right. So necessity of consequences. This is a necessity brought about or conditioned by a previous contingent act or event, so that the necessity arises out of contingent circumstances. So again, there are downstream effects. If something's necessary, it can have necessary downstream effects. Okay. A necessity of nature. This is a limit of thought and action grounded in the being itself. So in other words, by my human nature, I cannot have an infinite understanding of things. That's a necessary necessity of nature. Okay, I cannot be everywhere at once. Necessity of a finite, limited nature. There's also a liberty of nature. This is the freedom that is proper to a being given its particular nature. So we have to ask that question. What liberty do we actually have? Do we have an autonomous libertarian liberty? Do we have a contingent liberty? Do we have a liberty that is secondary, that is based off of another type of liberty? Do we have a liberty that's born out of our nature? what else do we have in here? Let's see. Okay. So those are a little bit of things about necessary versus contingency. So now let's jump into types of causes. So a cause is simply that which brings about motion or mutation that is in effect. In other words, it's going to start something, end something, or change something. A power is the capability or ability to affect that motion or mutation. So in other words, if I have the power to do something, then I have a power to affect a motion or a change or something of that nature, end something. So what are the types of causation that are generally accepted? No, there's a couple of them. First, we have the material cause. Now the material cause is the substantial basis for motion and mutation. In other words, it's the material on which the efficient cause operates. So when we say a material cause, we're not talking about a decision or something. We're just talking about a thing that can be changed. A thing that can be operated on. Okay. So what's interesting is God cannot be a material cause. Efficient causes cannot operate on him. So that's an interesting kind of notion, whereas virtually everything else in the created can be a material cause. So again, the material cause is just the substance. So, you know, my water bottle, it can be a material cause. The water in here, a material cause. In fact, you know, the fact that I put water in this water bottle and now the water takes this form, the water was a material cause. You know, for my chair, the stuff it's built out of is a material cause. So a material cause and just the material itself are kind of synonymous terms. The efficient cause, though, is the one that we have to pay very careful attention to. The efficient cause is the productive or effective cause, which is the agent productive of the motion or mutation in any sequence of causes and effects. So the efficient cause is, again, the agent that is producing the motion mutation. It's the efficient cause. What caused efficient cause to get this water? Well, I had to do something. Me. Okay. What's a deficient cause? Well, this kind of causation is employed by Augustinian theologians. The reason that since God created all things good, there can be no evil thing that exists as an efficient cause of sin. Thus, sin must arise out of a deficiency of willing rather than an efficiency of willing. That is, a willing of something not as it ought to be willed. Now, that's an interesting way to think about it, this deficient cause. In other words, we should be willing one thing, God's will, but we're deficient in some way. Our will is deficient, thus sin, thus evil. It's an interesting way to think about it. We'll dive into that more probably later, or you can ask questions about it. Okay? A formal cause. A formal cause is the essence of the thing, determinative of what the thing caused is to be. So for example, let's use my water bottle. The blueprint of the water bottle is the formal cause. Okay, the blueprint told, so here, let me arrange these. Well, actually, we'll have one more, and then I'll arrange them so you can see how this all plays out. Finally, there's a final cause. These are the four main causes of Aristotle. The final cause is the ultimate purpose for which a thing is made or an act is performed. So let's walk through all of these. So you have this idea. And by the way, there's a lot of philosophy in this, because once we get into it, we've got to use these terms. We've got to know what we're talking about. In terms of this water bottle, there is a blueprint for who made the water bottle. Okay, that's the formal cause. There's a blueprint. Then there was a final cause. Somebody had to say, well, I'm making the water bottle so somebody can hold water and drink out of it. That's the final cause. It's the purpose. Then there was a material cause. In other words, the stuff this is made out of and the water that's in there. And there was a series of efficient causes. One, to build the water bottle. Efficient cause. People had to choose to do that. And I had to choose to put water in there and choose to drink it. So that's a little bit about how causation is described. There's also an impelling or impulsive cause. It provides an opportunity for the efficient cause of the choosing. It's a cause that precedes and prepares, but it's not efficient. For example, human misery is an external impelling case of divine mercy. In other words, another thing is, an impelling or impulsive cause, it would be something like, I see someone suffering, and that moves me to act on their behalf. Well, why did I act on their behalf? Well, I acted because such and such. Okay. Approximate cause is a closely related cause. So, you know, there are things that can act in that way. Remote causes are not related to an effect. A first or prime cause. Now, this is the idea of God as the cause of all things, the prime mover, if you will. Because God is uncaused and non-contingent, he's necessary, absolute, infinite, and eternal. He had to be the first cause. He had to cause something to come into being. Okay? Now, another key cause is a secondary cause. This is the affecting of the divine will in and through the finite order of creation. Generally, God acts mediately through secondary and instrumental causes. Okay? An instrumental cause is simply the means to bring about a desired effect. So, for example, God ordained and caused Jesus to die on a cross. He did so through secondary and instrumental causation. In other words, the actions of others. And that's, by the way, how God can both be the one who caused it and also it be an evil sin of someone else. Okay. A free cause. So what is actually a free cause? Well, it's a cause that operates not out of necessity or compulsion, but freely. For example, God is the cause of man's salvation insofar as God is not compelled by necessity to be gracious to his fallen creatures. How about a meritorious cause? Well, this is an instrumental cause that contributes to a desired effect by rendering the effect worthy of taking place. For example, the death of Christ is the meritorious cause of salvation. Okay, so it can make other things happen. So let's talk a little more again about this agent causation. Well, regarding free choice, God affects the decree, so in other words, he carries out his decree, his will, by permitting the free operation of secondary causes. Okay, so this is the key. We don't get prime causation. We don't get the truly uncaused cause level of causation. That's libertarian. What we get is a free operation of secondary causes. In each instance of free choice of his creatures, God upholds the efficiency of the decree. So in other words, he is causing what he wants to happen in the free choice of his creatures and the freedom of his creatures by decreeing the circumstances and conditions of the event. For example, to have a particular instance of free choice, God decrees the following. The agent's volitional faculty shall be free, but limited by the nature of the agent. The agent's conditions and circumstances shall be what they are. The present conditions and circumstances shall be what they are. The choice of the free creature shall be spontaneous and free. So again, we have this situation in which we make choices. Now, unlike middle knowledge, I would say that we don't make choices simply because, like, we're sort of locked in because of our situations. However, God does know what decisions we're going to make because he knows all things and has decreed it. Okay, it's simple foreknowledge, simple decree. Okay, so again, we are locked in, but we're still making a free choice. Okay, we're going to do this, but it is also our choice to do it. God willed Jesus to die on a cross, and yet people had to actually choose to nail him to the cross. So we're going to pause there for tonight. That's about 40 minutes. And before we get on any more, I think the next thing we're going to get into the biblical understanding of the decree. So we're going to get into the Bible terms next time in 2 weeks. We're going to get into the biblical theology of the decree, a lot more Bible verses. But we had to at least talk about these things now. So I'm going to go ahead and take a look and see if we have any questions. So let's go ahead and hop on here. Do we have any questions? We do. We do have a couple questions. So Joe, if you could post. Thank you so much, Joe. If you post those questions, great. First one, why can't God allow things he didn't directly cause, but that he, being all-powerful, can turn to his ultimate will? Okay, so the first issue with this statement I want to just go ahead and describe is that is sort of that's an issue even in the statement of that question. And again, this is not, I'm not mocking or anything like that. I'm just simply walking through this. So why can't God allow things he didn't directly cause? So if he, now, well, okay, so first off, that's the first issue. Directly cause. We have to understand that in God's causation, he has a will. He executes that will perfectly. All that he wills comes to pass. But within his will, there are things he directly causes and there are things he permits secondarily. Okay, so that's a key understanding that he permits things secondarily. Okay, so I'm going to amend that and say that it's not directly caused. So we'll say it like this: why can't God allow things secondarily that maybe he doesn't know? Okay, being all powerful and can turn to his ultimate will. Well, the problem is first is the issue of ultimate will. If his will is truly ultimate, then his will is perfect. It will get executed exactly as is. So he doesn't have to rely on other things. Otherwise, he doesn't even have an ultimate will. Secondarily, if people can do things outside of God's will, we have this issue where people can actually make a real and legitimate claim to essentially either being God or to being better than God. Like, they have a claim on it because there's something that they can now do. There's a will they can act. They can now vie against the Lord Almighty, potentially legitimately, and actually try to make a claim on this. Now, they're just still weak, but theoretically, if they can effect enough change, they could turn the course of history away from what God wants. And arguably, that's sort of the issue. If this can happen, then Satan and the fallen angels could theoretically have turned the course of history away from what God had intended. And that's very dangerous. That's a dangerous way to go about things. So that's the reason why, a couple of the reasons why. Next question. Didn't Adam and Eve have complete freedom in their choice to sin or not in the garden? They did not, actually. And we have not gotten to this because we have not done anthropology, human nature. But Adam and Eve, so just so you know, and again, no hardship in here, that view is called Pelagianism. It's the idea that they have complete autonomous freedom, that they were essentially neutral or blank slates, and they had the full choice to either sin or not sin. In reality, they were in concreated holiness. So they were in a co-action whereby God created them holy, choosing the good. They were choosing the good. And then essentially, at one point, they willed sin. They willed evil. They had to actually go against that and do that. So it was not complete freedom. That was a defect in their will, essentially, that led to this. In Romans 8:29, it says that God predestines those he foreknew. Does that mean he knew middle knowledge what they would choose and use that as a basis to predestine elect? So this is very key. Now we are going to cover this in depth. So I'm not going to dive into this too much right now because this is probably going to be either next time or the time after that. I do want to spend some time in this since it's a big issue, but I will answer it now. So again, God predestines those he foreknew. Does that mean he knew? Now, if we're going by middle knowledge, that's sort of part of the question, I guess. What would they choose and then use that as a basis to predestine elect? So one possibility, if you're going the Arminian route, is that God bases his predestination and election upon his free knowledge or middle knowledge of human decisions. So that's going to be the Arminian view, is that he actually bases who he elects on that middle knowledge. Okay. There's some problems with that, though. There's some serious problems with that, though. One of those problems is the idea of once he's based it on something you've done or he knows you will do, what is that? I mean, you can't even get around speaking of it in those terms. Salvation is now contingent on you. And there's serious issues with that, especially when we start to get into human nature and the reality that there is none who seeks God. Okay, so I would argue that he does not do that. But again, the middle knowledge, that's what they're going to say, actually. So yes, that is what they would say. I would disagree, and we'll talk about why in a later talk or during our discussion. If God determines the outcome of every dice roll, isn't that more like hard determinism? Well, remember, compatibilism states that every event is determined. So yes, actually he does determine every dice roll. It is. The difference between hard determinism and compatibilism is that human free choices are not coerced in a deterministic way. They have external causation, but they also have the real effect of agency. In other words, people really do choose. Okay. But he does determine the outcome of every dice roll. No, there's no doubt about it. There is no such thing as luck or coincidence. These things happen for a reason. And there are times in this world where we see that actually occur. It's fascinating. Is Pharaoh's heart hardening and subsequent choices not a violation of will by God according to compatibilism? So now this is where there's a couple of different issues at play here with the hardening of the heart. And there is the verses, and I don't know if I read them in this one. I don't think I did. I was doing that in a different talk. Yeah, talk the other day, yesterday that I did, which we're probably going to post some of it online as well. And hardening of Pharaoh's heart. So Paul's understanding of hardening of Pharaoh's heart is hardening it for judgment. Now, the real question, though, is this, is when we talk about hardening his heart, when we talk about vessels prepared for destruction, and we will get to that, don't worry. Again, because a lot of these things are going to come up in the next two talks. We have to ask ourselves this question. Hardening of the heart, is that forcing a person to decide a certain way, or is it essentially strengthening their will to such an extent they can do what they wanted to do? Is it actually more allowing them to do what they wanted them to do, what a person wants to do? Again, hardening of the heart. What does that even mean in terms of scripture? Well, let's talk about it. There's two essential things we have to keep in mind when discussing that verse. The first is that hardening of Pharaoh's heart is in reference to the Egyptian hardening of the heart ceremony. I mean, it's the same. Same kind of thing. And the reason why is because they essentially would harden the heart so it couldn't speak out against you when you spoke during the death ritual and with an Anubis. And then, you know, the feather outweighs the heart kind of thing. The heart couldn't speak out against you, so it's hardened. And they did it with a scarab and a ritual incantation. Now, when God hardened Pharaoh's heart, first off, that was a declaration that God could control Pharaoh as God. So in other words, Pharaoh claimed to be God. God said, no, I actually am sovereign over you through that hardening of the heart statement. So that was actually one way that God declared his sovereignty and superiority to Pharaoh. A second thing, though, is that if you remember, the plagues actually scared Pharaoh pretty hard, and he kept letting the people go. But the problem is he didn't actually want to do that. So actually, for God not to harden his heart would have actually been more along the lines of taking away his free will or coercing the choice, because Pharaoh was doing something he didn't want to do. He didn't want to let the people go. So actually, the hardening of the heart made it so that Pharaoh was going to do what was in his heart to do in the first place. So that's kind of an important historical interpretive thing to understand about that one. Okay, what's the difference between directly willing and permitting evil? Directly willing evil would be like doing the evil yourself. Permitting evil means you don't restrain a person's nature to keep them from committing sin. So there is that aspect of them that can will evil, and you allow them to do so. That's the difference. If we're truly free, are we truly free if we're bound by limitation to secondary causes? Well, here'd be my question. If we're truly free, how can we be held accountable to anything? So again, the problem is if we're truly free, we would spontaneously make decisions out of nowhere. So we base our decisions all the time on things. And in fact, if you actually think about every time you make a decision, there's reasons why you make decisions. We don't actually make decisions out of nothing. We don't make these decisions out of nothing. So the question is, are we truly free? No, we're not. We're actually not truly free. And that's the key. We are free enough, and we have the right type of freedom to our nature. We have the freedom to choose, but we don't have the freedom to recreate our will. And that's the fundamental problem, is that we have a fallen will. We have a will that is set against God, pre-being saved anyway. We have a will that's set against God. And the reality is, as we continue to choose in line with it, that's why the non-Christian will never simply just choose to love God. Now, that's jumping ahead a bit, and we will discuss that as well later. But that's the issue, is no, we're not truly libertarian free. We are free, but it's a derivative will. It's a will permitted by God, essentially. And it is known by God because he does know how we are going to act in certain situations. I'm not disagreeing with that. What I disagree with is the idea that is middle knowledge as a philosophical construct, I think, is not where I would land. So again, we are not truly free. We are free in that we are accountable, but we don't have a level of freedom that God himself has. It's a very good question. These are some excellent ones. All right, I will wait just a moment and see if there are any more questions. I'm also going to quickly check my phone to see if I can do my thing here. All right, Zoom is free. Excellent. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to post the Zoom link into the live chat. So make sure if you're here, go ahead and check that live chat. We will get on our Zoom link and have a good time here. And I did not give Joe the questions, but that's actually okay. I'm going to do that differently anyway, because I didn't know how far I was going to get with this one. So Joe, I'll be giving you those questions momentarily. All right, so we need to delete that one. We need to go home, new meeting, join computer audio. Yep, I know you cannot start the video. That is correct. Participants, invite, copy, invite link. Okay, we're going right back here. All right, so I'm pasting this. There's the Zoom link. And secondly, I am going to paste the password in case we need it, because I never know whether or not we need the password. It is 062853. 062853. There we go. All right. So you guys can go ahead and begin joining. And it seems like there are four concurrent viewers, I believe, right now. So once I get those in, if you do come in, I'll wait a few minutes here while everybody logs into the Zoom who wants to join us for the discussion, and then we will proceed from there. So, all right, well, I will go ahead and say goodbye to everybody else. So thank you so much for joining us for this session of Cleaning House, and I hope you guys had a good time. I hope there's a lot to think about, and I'm very excited to meet with you guys again in 2 weeks, where we're going to further dive into the biblical understanding of divine decree. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close my thing here so I can get into the Zoom call. Anybody else wants to join, feel free and click on those links, we will go from there. All right, YouTube and stream, and there we go.